and welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger Podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. We're halfway through August, and the back-to-school commercials are in heavy rotation on television. That can mean only one thing. Fall's just around the corner, and with it, the return of millions of students to the classroom. While we read all the time about the theft of data from financial institutions, from hospitals and healthcare facilities, and retailers, what about our schools? Colleges and universities, let alone K through 12 schools and school systems, hold vast troves of data on their current and former students. This includes not just the courses they take and how they did in them, but loads of personally identifying information, or PII, such as social security numbers, email and physical addresses, as well as health and mental health records. How well do schools guard this data? Not very well, according to data analyst Leah Figueroa, who has researched the issue. Figueroa, who works at a community college in Texas, notes that institutions like her employer regularly divulge records on tens or even hundreds of thousands of current and former students every year, no questions asked. This despite a federal law that, in theory, protects student data, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974, otherwise known as FERPA. In this podcast, we talk with Leah about her research, what she discovered, and how this huge transfer of student data happens day in, day out, with little notice.
With the student data, it's everything but their grades, at least with some of the directory information. Like, I was able to, from one school, I was able to get information about their parents as well, because that's listed as student directory information. And some colleges list things such as their picture and all kinds of information. So some colleges won't tell you when a student graduated, but they'll provide you what degree they earned and what semesters they were at the college. So you can easily infer what degrees they were earned when they earned them. And you can use them to do stuff like construct fake identities. You can use them to stalk people. You can use them to do pretty much anything. And the further I dug, the worse it looked.
Among this, I guess, is personally identifiable information. Is that right? Like social security numbers and that type of thing?
Yes. Social security numbers aren't on there, but you can sometimes pull a student ID. So some places will actually have a copy of your student ID. So you can use the student ID to kind of spoof your information. And you have things such as local address, home address. It's not just a person's name and they went to this college. It's this person's name. If you participate in sports, they can have your height and weight on there as well. But even worse is if someone has moved colleges and don't realize that, you know, because something has happened or they're being tracked or something along those lines, if you don't check the privacy box, someone can just go look you up and find out what dorm you're living in.
Even that kind of information is obtainable from these schools.
Yes. And I mean, it really depends on the college's definition of directory information. But the Department of Education basically said that it's totally up to the school to decide what they want to give. It's much easier for the school to just not opt people in, because if someone asks for data, they can just hand it over. So I think we've just kind of are starting to make student data into a commodity instead of actually, you know, what colleges were originally intended.
You work within an office that gets these requests. What can you tell us about the types of requests you get and who they're coming from or where they're coming from and what your sense is of how this data, the student data, is being used?
It's a wide variety. You have everything from other colleges. I should preface it. We are not allowed to vet the requests when they come in the form of a FOIA request. So I can't bet that this person who says they're from a college is actually from a college, but based on what they've requested, it's things such as everything from a predatory loan company to a company looking to solicit students to buy cars to other colleges are seeking to have students transfer in. We've had requests just for the data without giving a reason why they need it. So I have no idea why they're using it. We have research projects that are requesting access to student data to send surveys or any number of things. And so, you know, I'm going to bet that most of them are really doing what they're saying they're doing. But this also is a treasure trove of PII that you can use to do other things. Most colleges, because of the whole having to verify that someone graduated and stuff, most of them have data on students that have graduated and they hold on to it for a long time. You know, I wouldn't say in perpetuity, but, you know, if someone graduated 30 years ago, you're not going to throw away the records that the student was there because you need them in order to verify that, you know, person had the degree. I'm assuming people are using it for exactly what they're saying, and then there are people who are using it for other purposes, and I can't tell you what they're doing with it.
Right. So behind this all is what's called the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA.
Yeah.
You mentioned it there. It's a law dating to 1974. It's supposed to protect the privacy of student education records. So why is all this not illegal under FERPA?
Because the government has decided that personally identifiable information doesn't count as an education record. That's all directory information. And the only thing that qualifies as an education record are grades and possibly when you graduated. So the only thing that's really defined is your grades and possibly disability status, but that usually goes under HIPAA protection. And I think it's worded in such a way to try and give colleges as much freedom as possible, but it also opens the door and allows the colleges to determine what is directory information. They're required by law to post what is included in the student directory. Often it's placed in the very front of the course catalog for that semester, stating what directory information is, what's included in it, all of the information. So usually that would be your name, address, phone number, birth date, dates of attendance, things like that, and that you do not have to be informed when this information is released unless you have opted out. On any given data, you know, where someone's asking for maybe 40,000 records, we might have 400 people who have opted out. So it's a very low number of students who opt out for this because they don't really know it's there.
What are the processes that schools use to allow students, again, it's, first of all, inform them that this directory information is available basically for sale or for free to anybody and to give them the ability to not have their information included?
That's the biggest problem. There is no standardized way. The law basically states that, or at least federal directives state that you have to let students know what's included in directory information and that you don't have to be informed when it's released and that there's a way to opt out. But the opt-out procedures are different for colleges and they're listed in different places. You can find it in a course catalog on some places. Some places it's on the website that you may have to select okay to register for your courses, but it's not in any way that's a standardized approach. You can't tell, you know, a group of people from 100 different colleges that you need to check your course catalog. It may be in the course catalog. It may be on a website. It may be in the front of the school fact book. It may be in some other esoteric place because there's no standardization across colleges. And the procedures can range from you sign in with your ID and are allowed to just opt out there. You have to physically be present. Some of them have warnings.
And is this has this always been the case with FERPA, or has there been a drift or a change in how the law is interpreted and enforced that is more permissive now, maybe than it was in the 70s?
The rules really haven't been. FERPA has not really been updated, and I think now that data has become such a valuable commodity, and people are starting to realize that you can pull it from schools with little to no issue.
You were able to download something like 20,000 student records from one of the colleges or universities you contacted, right?
That's the one I paid $50 for, and they processed it all. And then I got an email, and they were basically asked me where I wanted to send the Excel file. And since I work with data, I have a secure cloud upload with encryption. And so I gave them that link, but they were perfectly fine just emailing me the list of students without the encrypted uplink. And when I actually looked, it was all their current students and their graduate students and international students and their international students' parents' names and just things that I shouldn't have this. I shouldn't be able to request this.
Well, I mean, as a reporter, you know, there's part of me that says, well, that's, you know, so as a member of the media, I want to be able to call up a university and say, did this person go to your university and when? And, you know, did they graduate?
Yeah.
And those types of things. Those seem like reasonable questions. I don't know that I need to know their mother's maiden name or you know, their date of birth or any of the other things. But yeah.
Yeah. And so for me, there's that one, you need to be able to verify because it does, you know, if someone comes in and says, I have a degree from this college, you should be able to because if you're doing something that needs something like you need a degree in education for this, you know, you should be able to verify that. But also, you know, knowing where you were born and knowing your current address versus your parents' address and knowing your height and weight or possibly what your student ID looks like they're not something that you need for verification.
Right. So we see this happen in a lot of areas with you know, kind of the advent of the internet, right? So I think about like property records and then sites like Zillow and Redfin that, you know, aggregate a lot of what had been public records. You know, anyone could get them, but you had to go into town hall, and now it's simply all online. Is this a manifestation of that problem where this thing that wasn't a problem in small scale suddenly at internet scale is a problem?
I think it's a combination of, you know, smaller scale, you know, that just kind of it's not morphing correctly. But also, previously, you would have to go in and request this data face to face. And so someone who is maybe not doing it, you know, they wouldn't be able to prove that it was them, you know, like, hi, I'm here to pick up the student data that, you know, the student data I requested. Well, now you can spoof all sorts of things on the internet. And so I think it's twofold. It's people not having any responsibility to treat the data appropriately. And then this has always been where you can go in and get stuff. Well, now you can just ask someone over the phone or ask someone over email. And so I think that's part of the problem. You know, with property records, you're not necessarily dealing with as much, like, I mean, there's a lot of information in the property records. But it's, I don't think it's for me, it's a more personal invasion because FERPA also extends down to K-12 students. And I wasn't even going to touch that because I am uncomfortable with the idea that you can request data on a sixth grader.
Oh, wow. And, so this applies to public, to K-12 as well as, community colleges.
Yeah.
Universities.
And I didn't do any of the research because I did not want to,
go there.
But FERPA covers from kindergarten or, you know, in early childhood, if you're enrolled in any of the early childhood programs, all the way through college.
Do we know if the Department of Education, which enforces FERPA, is aware of these limitations and whether this is an issue in any way at the, you know, within the DOE or at within Washington, D.C. in a policy level at all?
They know of the issue, and they, at least from what's gone on. So a few years ago, there was a rape on a college, an alleged rape on a college. The alleged rapists were never taken to trial. But during that course of the trial, some of her, of the woman's records, medical records, because she sought mental health treatment after the alleged rape, at the college, and then she sued the college because they took so long to investigate. The college used those medical records, and because they access them, there's a loophole in FERPA that allows those HIPAA-protected records to become FERPA-only protected records. And so the Department of Education at that point put out a call for people to maybe have some feedback about FERPA protection and maybe if it should be strengthened, and it never went anywhere and it just got kind of buried back in the DOE. And when questioned about the legality of someone from the college accessing these medical records and them losing HIPAA protection and only maintaining that FERPA protection because they weren't grades, these were considered part of the education record and they were considered part of her directory information. And the DOE was like, well, that's just how it is.
So talk just a little bit, because I know in your presentation that you gave, you do talk about this specifically. What are the steps by which health information, like, you know, records of sessions with a physician or a psychotherapist, which are protected under the HIPAA patient data privacy law, become unprotected student directory information under FERPA? What's the kind of the two-step that by which that happens?
Basically, when anyone other than your medical provider at the college or your designated medical provider from outside of the college accesses your record. So, for instance, if you're diagnosed with a health condition while in college, well, if you may need physical copies of your medical records, if you ask to see your medical records because you are not the medical provider or your other designated medical provider, that's what trips that. It's just anyone else looking at those records. And that wouldn't occur anywhere else but in college.
So is it only you looking at your own medical record, or could it be anybody looking at your medical record outside of your provider?
I think if it's anyone, so at least from how I understand, I'm not a lawyer, but at least from how I understand it, is if anyone that is not you or not your medical provider or your designated one, it looks at it. So perhaps you're at a psychiatric issue and you've been seeking psychiatric help, and then you have a breakdown and they look at it to gauge whether or not you're a safety concern for the college. The very act of doing that allows those records to lose that protection.
So is there any awareness on the part of the education community around this issue of how to protect their students' data, or is this not so much of a topic of conversation?
It's not so much a topic of conversation. I've been to some education, retreats and education conferences, and whenever I bring it up, I'm kind of met with, well, of course, that's how we, give student data out when people request it. It's a non-issue, and it's kind of concerning to me because it shouldn't be a non-issue. If this were CEO data getting out, there would be an uproar.
How many requests does your college handle in an average year for student data, and how many records would you estimate you're distributing out to whomever?
Externally, we probably handle, not including what people we have data sharing agreements with, probably about 30 to 40. And it's anywhere from 40,000 records to, I think, I had 10 years of records for about 90,000 students a year, so 900,000 records.
Wow. That's just in 1 year.
Because some people want several years, and you could have students that are duplicated, but those are on average about that. So
what's your fix? What do you think is the right way to do it? You want to support researchers and people who are providing needed services to students, and then you want to obviously protect students from predatory lenders or people trying to do identity theft and those types of problems.
I think limiting directory information to things such as just their name, whether or not they attended, what year they attended, and the degrees and things like that would cut down on the ability to pull all of this without compromising legitimate research. I think tightening it up and actually defining directory information on a federal level might actually help tighten some of this up.
Leah Figueroa, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with the Security Ledger podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Next up, in July, the technology press was abuzz with warnings about the Devil's Ivy, a serious security hole in GSOAP, a common open source library that's used in hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of connected devices. With information both on the vulnerability and how to exploit it in the public domain, however, we still haven't seen any Devil's Ivy attacks, at least none that we know of. Why? Asaf Harel of the firm Karumba thinks that Devil's Ivy is going to be a big problem.
It's not the last time that we see Devil's Ivy. We're going to see Devil's Ivy repeat itself time and time again, and not a different vulnerability, this specific vulnerability. And the reason is that IoT devices are not updating, are not patching. So what happened just a week ago, 2 weeks ago, it's going to repeat itself, just like NotPetya repeated WannaCry, and will probably repeat itself again and again. The only reason we'll not see a lot of commotion about it is maybe because they know how to hide them. But it will definitely be used again and again, and the reason is that IoT devices do not fix vulnerabilities.
Asaf, is Devil's Ivy already being used, and maybe we're just unaware of it?
I don't know. I won't be shocked.
You've said that you think that Devil's Ivy is going to be as bad as, if not worse, than the Eternal Blue exploit in Windows. Talk about why.
We know what the GSOAP maintainer said. The GSOAP maintainer said that there are 26, I think, different IoT devices that are using GSOAP. But I think he was being modest. I think he doesn't know all of them, because it's open source. The proliferation is something that is out of the control of the maintainer. IoT companies are still lacking in their security monitoring practice. So it depends on the industry, and it depends on, sometimes it's also depend, it also depends on the country, regulations that the, so in the US, automotive companies are very aware, medical companies are very aware, but camera surveillance companies, home appliances, no, they're not very aware. And maybe we will not hear about it because it's so quiet, you know, it was, and maybe we will not hear about it because there are things that are easier. Maybe the path to a ransomware is longer with Devil's Ivy, and you can, you know, use something else. But this is, I mean, this is not a security philosophy. This is like sheer luck.
Asaf Harel of Karumba, thanks for taking time to speak with the Security Ledger.
Bye. Good luck with this piece.
And finally, why do companies have such a hard time securing their networks from attack? Ashwin Almed of the firm Endgame joined us in the Security Ledger studio to talk about a new survey her firm did with Forrester Research that sought to answer that question. It found two likely culprits, complexity and a lack of skilled security workers.
Right, they have many tools in their environment. They have point solutions, and they need people to manage that. That is creating a huge challenge in terms of the simplicity which a CISO actually wants in their environment.
Ashwini, one of the big takeaways from this survey you did with Forrester was that almost all of your respondents, 92%, said that they'd been a victim of a successful cyber attack in the previous year. That's a tough number.
So, like you said, right, 92% of these respondents have experienced at least one attack. And just to add to that data point, 40% of those respondents are facing an attack daily in their environment. These attacks are, you know, phishing, malware, targeted attacks.
Right. One of the takeaways was they're having a really hard time finding skilled workers or cultivating, developing the workers they do have into those what are called tier one, the sort of most skilled, most highly skilled analysts who can really dig into cyber incidents. How does that ultimately affect the ability of companies to respond to threats?
Right. So the skills gap in the security industry is something which is well known, and a lot of our customers and prospects, you know, are facing the same issue. A majority of the executives categorize their staff's proficiency not only as competent, but like you mentioned, 44% of these are tier one analysts. And the survey definitely made it very clear for us that executives are struggling to find and retain analysts. You know, it's very not only hard to retain a tier one analyst, but also a tier three analyst. You know, people are looking, there are just so many analysts which can come out of the three-letter agencies who can help resolve these complex attacks, which is why we have focused this past year in building the industry's first ever chatbot called Artemis. The whole concept of Artemis is combination of domain expertise with natural language understanding to allow analysts of tier one's skill level to ask simple questions and reach and get definite answers to stop attacks in time. The whole point of Artemis is to elevate your existing tier one analyst and accelerate the tier three analyst.
Does that scale? Is that something that is practical? And do you know that the outcome or the end results are the same as if you just had a really skilled and trained human being?
Right. So I think the terms like machine learning and AI are such buzzwords right now in the industry, right? So a lot, but you know, the security industry as a whole, we as a security industry are making strides in machine learning, AI to help stop malware and in the technology itself. One of the unique things which we are focusing here on is looking at, you know, instead of using complex queries, which a tier two or tier three analyst only knows by practicing over years of experience. Basically, how can you simply break it down into a few sentences, right? Every analyst cares about three questions. Has this happened in my environment? Where is it? And how bad is it? So as long as in simple English, if you are able to respond to these three questions, that basically helps give enough information to an analyst to make the right decision on how they want to kill that process or kill that the threat itself. So yes, I do believe strongly that technology like NLU technology, especially the endgame Artemis technology, and we have also seen that in our customers, that has really accelerated the tier one analysts who always had a tier three looking on their shoulder, helping them and trying to get them to do that next step. Just this chatbot is basically, that help guide without learning multiple languages or multiple queries, right? It's a simple way of getting to know your environment and helping you get there. And that's a trend which we see in most of our day-to-day life right now. Why not use it in security?
So just to parse what you said, I mean, the difference would be that instead of having to create a complex query using a special query language, it might be different for each tool. They can ask more sort of traditional English language sentences and get a response also more or less in English, telling them what the problem is and what to do about it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, simple English, simple answers, so definitive answers. So let me just give you an example. You could ask Artemis, what is bad in my network today, right? There has been a barrage of reports around fileless attacks. Just ask Artemis, is there a fileless attack in my environment today? So just simple questions to help the tier one analyst or the tier three analyst, whoever chooses to use it, to get them to a point where they can actually resolve that and stop the breaches happening in the environment before any kind of damage and loss occurs.
Right. Do you see a point in the future where that tier one analyst position really goes away, or even the tier one and tier two, and that can be handled entirely in software, and then maybe humans are involved in the most technical or complex incident response and forensic operations?
So the goal of building this tool was not to eliminate any tier one analysts. It was primarily to make sure that the experience, the learning which you get of, being in that role for years, basically able to package that in a simple box and be able to help them, guide through that. It was more of a guided response. I don't believe that for years to come now, we will be eliminating that tier one or tier three analyst. I feel that this is only to address we are always going to need the people to make the final calls. And what Artemis would do is basically help them give that right information to make that call.
Ashwin
Alma, I appreciate your time.
Endgame, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with the Security Ledger.